eyes, every ray of sunlight that kisses my skin. The face of beauty appears in every step, every sunrise, every ray of sunlight that kisses my skin.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. It's a full moon. It's very much a full moon, and that's all we're going to deal with until 3 a.m. It's sort of a blue moon. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. We tend to take for granted when watching a movie the objectivity of the camera. It's a tool, after all, a machine whose only function is to capture what's placed in front of it. It has no investment in anything it observes. That assumption is automatic. We don't consciously consider it, and it's the thing that in part leads to stuff like the put-down-the-damn-camera syndrome in found-footage mockumentary horror films, those moments when the character wielding the camera keeps filming when, logically, he should just drop the thing and get his buttocks out of there. There are a couple of small but notable moments in the new found footage ghost story, The Midnight Swim. In one, a woman, June, played by Lindsay Burge, films her two sisters, the pragmatic Annie, played by Jennifer LaFleur, and the more impulsive Isa, played by Alexa Palladino, as they meet with a real estate agent to sell their home in the wake of their mother's mysterious disappearance while diving into the lake behind the house. The two on-camera sisters have differing opinions about whether to sell, but even as June proclaims she's taking no sides, she pushes her camera into the agent's face, a passive-aggressive assault that visibly disturbs the woman. Later on, the three sisters are having breakfast in the dining room while the camera sits on a tripod. June, oddly, is barely visible, hanging off the edge of the frame. And when Isa begins to accuse Annie of hypocrisy for trying to invoke some kind of familial bond between the three of them, and an argument ensues, June stands and picks up the camera to get close-ups of the quarreling women. This could have been a practical consideration. Director Sarah Dina Smith, who also wrote the script, orchestrating this move to get her close-ups without cheating cuts, although she has no problem cheating elsewhere. But note again, the camera takes June's part, becomes an extension of her character rather than just a passive recording device. This becomes important as the film progresses and strange time-lapse shots of the lake begin to show up, shots that June swears she was not responsible for. Found footage has become overall a thoroughly debased genre. It's used more now to cover a lack of budget or to permit filmmakers to slack off on intelligent plotting or decent cinematography. Director Smith has broken the mold through a number of gambits, that unusual blurring of character and camera for one, for another that the film overall is beautifully photographed, no technical shortcuts here, and another is that she essentially ignores the pretense to documentary, even more than so-called mockumentaries that somehow manage to work in very undocumentary background music and editing styles. The supposedly impromptu footage, some of which may actually have been improvised, is used more for impressionistic purposes. There's even a lip-synced music video thrown in. And the story, taking in myths both classic and local, and the mother's scientific research into the strange effects the apparently bottomless lake has on mind and body, places a premium on enigma and on the personal dynamics of the three sisters. It's not completely seamless. Smith throws in a fake-out scare moment that's straight out of the Horror 101 textbook. There are details about the sisters' backgrounds that are abruptly invoked when some sort of audience priming would have given them more impact. And towards the end, two of the sisters behave in a way that makes little sense beyond setting up the third sister for her final, fateful act. The film will not sit well with some. If you were annoyed in general by Lost, and in particular by its finale, you'll probably have your patience tested by The Midnight Swim's ambiguities. As for me, I found it a rare, beautiful, emotionally gripping exploration of the supernatural. And I'm sure glad nobody decided to put down the camera. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Thank you, Dan. Okay, so as I was saying, it's the start of a blue moon. It's not exactly a blue moon. This is a cheat. Well, first of all, it's not even a proper blue moon. A proper blue moon, okay, is when you have 13 full moons in a year. And that means that in one quarter, somewhere in such a year, you would have four moons in a three-month period. And in that case, the third moon of the four is a blue moon. That happens like every 7 to 9 years on the average, but it's very unpredictable. But somewhere in the 1940s, Sky and Telescope magazine made a mistake, and which is rare, but they made a major mistake in the etymology of the blue moon. What they said was that a blue moon was when there were two full moons in one month, and then the second of the two full moons in that month was a blue moon. Well, people accepted that. They thought it was cool, and that is today what people often call a blue moon. It's not truly accurate, but hey, why not celebrate the funness of full moons, hey? Tonight is the first full moon of July, and there will be another one on Friday. What will be the date exactly? Let's see. This computer won't tell me. It'll be like the 30th or the 31st. It has to be. It only happens generally in months where with 31 days. Okay? It just tends to work out that way. But here we have it. So, since I won't be on the air on a Friday night when the actual blue moon occurs, the actual fake blue moon occurs, I will be on the air tonight. And this is the first of the two full moons in July. So this is the pre-blue moon show. And therefore, in search for a theme for the morning, I figured, why not do moony stuff, as it were? And what better way than to start it off with a wee bit of music?
Standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for. Suddenly appeared before me, the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. a dream in my heart without a love of my own. New moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then they suddenly appeared before me, the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
Do I have to tell you who that was? I hope not. I really hope not. Actually, yeah, I think Teddy Wilson would have been playing in the background there, but, maybe even Prez was there. But that was Billie Holiday, in case you didn't know. If you didn't know, go out, find some more, because it's worth it. So, the first thing I thought of was the short story by Larry Niven called Inconstant Moon. But Inconstant Moon takes up pretty much an entire, more than we've got. When Hour of the Wolf was 2 hours long, I think I got it in about an hour and 40 minutes. And it's a wonderful, entertaining story. And I highly recommend it. But we can't fit it in this morning. But here's something that I've played on the air at least twice before, so this will be a third time. And before I tell you what it is, I'll tell you what we will have later. We will have segments of the novel Amnesia Moon, read by the author, Jonathan Lethem, from the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And that will be from the year aught, the year 2000, October 19th, to be precise. But before we get to that, and that runs about half an hour, we have a shorter piece, a warm-up piece, and a funny, clever, clever piece from Alyssa Quitney Sheckley. Ziva, I hope you're listening. And if not, I'll let you know tomorrow. You can still hear it. And Elisa, for that matter. I'll let you both know. I've been in touch with them since. Now, Alyssa Quitney was scheduled to read at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Readings on, let's see, I'm really glad that I put the years on these labeled recordings. My old recordings are worthless. The labels have all fallen off and stuff like that, but the digital ones, at least, I can put my hands on and figure them out. So this is from 2009, November 11th, 11-11-2009. And I didn't know that well who Alyssa Quitney was. I had looked her up, and I saw that she was very popular doing some romance stuff. She had done some wonderful comic book stuff. And by the way, she is doing some of that again at DC Comics or Vertigo. What is the title she's working on now? I've forgotten. I know Genevieve Valentine, of course, is doing Catwoman, but Alyssa is doing, well, some other female-empowered character at this time, and I forget who. No, it's not Wonder Woman. I don't believe it's Supergirl. Actually, it could be. It could be. At any rate, what I did not quite get, what I did not realize, that Elisa Quitney's full name would be Elisa Quitney Sheckley. She is the daughter of Robert Sheckley. And this gave her DNA the opportunity to tell herself, you know, I ought to write some science fiction and fantasy. And it should be funny. And she did so, proving herself, I would say, the equal of her father in a number of respects. And since then, I've worked with her, hope to work with her again, at the, brought her in and her mother to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings to do a tribute to Robert Sheckley. But, and she did a wonderful reading of the short story Warm with Michael Swanwick, and I filmed that. There is so much mugging in that, well worth it. But here is a very short story, actually a segment of a novel, runs 14 minutes and change, about a woman who has issues whenever a full moon should appear. So set your Wayback Machine to November 11th, 2009, to the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, and the wonderful work of Elisa Quitney.
Hold on.
Rolling.
We're rolling. All right. Do you buy books? Because if you didn't, you're a bad person.
That's Matt Kressel.
And get them signed. That's an edict. My name is Matt Kressel. I'm the co-host here with Ellen
Datlow. I just told them that.
The KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series. It's held on the third Wednesday of every month. Thank you for coming. Our next reader is Elisa Quitney. Elisa Quitney's most recent novel since... Hold on.
Rolling.
We're rolling. All right. Did you buy books? Because if you didn't...
I don't know why that happened. Bear with me. We're going to skip ahead to where we were. I must have pressed something.
Thank you for coming. Our next reader is Elisa Quitney. Elisa Quitney's most recent novels include, writing as Elisa Sheckley, The Better to Hold You and Moonburn, a two-part series about a young woman who contracts lycanthropy from her cheating husband. Her next project is a Vertigo graphic novel about a little old Jewish lady and the angel of death. Here's Elisa Quitney.
Hi. Where do I talk into this? Is this audible?
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to be here. When I first met Ellen, I was very young, and she was very young. She was actually my father, Robert Sheckley's assistant, when he was associate at Omni. I was young. I didn't know the difference. I was very, very impressed. And she was very kind to me at science fiction conventions, as I can recall. It's all wrong. I started out writing as Elisa Quitney, which is my mother's maiden name, and at a certain point, I think I frightened my editor and my agent with this book that I'd written, which was a werewolf book, but I'd originally written it before werewolves became so very sexy, and they said, why don't you write it under another name? And I thought, you know, and asked permission back when my father was still alive and giving permission. And he said it was all right to exploit the family name. So Anyway, I am not actually two completely different people. I am, and even though this book looks, I think, like a paranormal romance or urban fantasy, it's a little bit different. The first book, which is, I think, the one they're selling there, tells the story of Abra Barrow, who is a veterinarian who's smart about animals and stupid about men. And her cheating husband gives her a dose of lycanthropy, which in my world is kind of like an STD. And she agrees to move upstate with him. Coincidentally, I left Manhattan and moved upstate. It has absolutely nothing to do with the book. But anyway, when I finally sold it, paranormal romance and urban fantasy had become this huge trend. And I was asked if I would do a second book in the series. And I got very intrigued with what would happen next to Abra up in the country. And at that point, I realized there were certain conventions that had developed to urban fantasy, paranormal romance. One is the kick-ass heroine. I do not naturally write very kick-ass heroines. And the other is this idea that the heroine is sort of man candy, that men are just instantly attracted to her like a bitch in heat. This is not naturally what I write. But I thought, well, this might be interesting to play with, along with the convention of the mousy librarian-like heroine who is transformed. So this is the second book in the series, Moonburn, and in it it's set mainly upstate, but in this one my heroine takes a little visit back to New York City, and basically she doesn't realize she's a little irregular in her cycle, first of all, and she doesn't realize that she's coming into heat, and she also doesn't realize that her werewolf cycles are sort of out of kilter. So she gets together with her friend Liliana, who's actually got some secrets of her own, and they're just kind of having a girly day shopping in Manhattan. Or so they think. This is Abra speaking to begin with. Lily, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but the truth is I'm pretty much invisible when I'm standing next to you. As if to prove my point, a businessman stopped talking into his cell phone long enough to give Liliana an appreciative look. We paused at the traffic light, and a souped-up Camaro zoomed past, honking its horn. Baby, called the driver. You're looking fine. Liliana tilted her head to one side. What do you mean, invisible? Oh, for crying out loud, Lily, take a look around. I gestured at the cyclist, the construction worker, and the businessman. You're like some kind of crazy man magnet. You can't walk two steps without some guy bugging you. Liliana stared at me as though I were going crazy. Abra, those guys were checking you out, not me. Oh, please. As a general rule, I do not cause men to fall off their bicycles. I pointed to the cyclist, who had been too busy watching us, to notice the taxi driver opening his door to spit on the sidewalk. The cyclist was on the street, rubbing his bruised chin, and the driver was yelling at him. Maybe you just don't notice, Liliana said. I put my hands on my hips. Lily, please, don't insult my intelligence. It's perfectly obvious which of us is attracting all the male attention. At that moment, I felt a sharp pinch on my left buttock. I whirled around and saw a young man in an anorak grinning at me as he darted out of the way. Give me a piece of that, he said, as if ordering something from the drive-thru. I'll give you a piece of something, I snarled. You were saying? The light turned green, Liliana took my arm again, and we crossed the street. Hey, said the cyclist, holding up one arm. Hang on. We paused, and he came up next to us, a smooth-skinned young man, a shade or two darker than Liliana. You all right, she asked. Just scratched my knee, he said. Thing is, I think I know you, he said, staring at me intently. I can't remember from where, but I know we've met. I rolled my eyes. Liliana, did you put these guys up to this? Is this the new ego boost? Instead of hiring your own paparazzi, you hire your own stalkers? No, really, I'm not fooling around, said the young man. And then he looked embarrassed. It's just, did you, and I feel this weird connection, like I'm drawn to you. I'm a great believer in listening to the heart, he explained. I'm a great believer in examining the head, I said, moving away from the cyclist. Liliana glanced over her shoulder. So this isn't your typical reaction from the male of the species? It must be a full moon, I said jokingly. Actually, it is, said Liliana, pointing up past the tall buildings at the translucent, swollen moon hanging in the pale winter sky. Almost, I corrected her. It looks full, but it's got another couple of days to go. because she keeps track of the moon cycles, as you would. Have you started carrying around a farmer's almanac? Come on, country girl, said Liliana. Here's the boutique I was telling you about. And there were three outfits in the window, all of them variations on white shirts and slender black skirts. There were also a few shoes, sexy and clunky in the style of the 1940s. The name of the shop was The Sexy Librarian. You're kidding me, there's an entire store devoted to the sexy librarian look? Liliana grinned as she opened the door. You see why I can never leave the city. It was my dream store. There were very few things in the shop, but all of them were perfect. White shirts that were nipped and tucked in just the right places with one-of-a-kind antique buttons. By the way, in the industry, this is known as girl porn. There were little navy dresses that radiated an understated funkiness that was almost but not quite frumpy. And there were racks of 1920s silky tap pants and stockings with seams up the back. The girls are getting excited. And camisoles and pinks and peaches and russets and plums, the color of the sunset as it deepened into night. Oh my God, I said. I want it all. I knew you'd love it, Liliana said happily, throwing things into my arms. Try this and this. Oh, and this. You have to try that on underneath. I ducked into the dressing room and wriggled into the camisole. I was still buttoning up the shirt when I emerged, but I thought I had the skirt on straight. Well, Lily, I said, what do you think? I think it's sort of like that Hitchcock scene where all the birds start roosting together, said Lily. And for a moment, I didn't understand what she was saying, because I was so surprised. The shop was filled with men. There were men crammed on either side of Liliana as if waiting for a dressing room and other men visible behind them checking out the sexy panties. I had seen the occasional hapless fiancé dragged into a store like this, but never a whole group of them. Huh, I thought, must be the new metrosexual fashion consciousness I keep reading about. And then I spotted the cyclist and I realized that something extremely peculiar was going on. I like it a lot, said the construction worker, who had crammed himself into a corner between the businessman, the cyclist, and a bunch of Japanese tourists. Go try something else on, said the cyclist. His voice sounded strained. Excuse me, said the saleswoman, a lovely young Asian woman who wore the sexy librarian look very well, but you're going to have to tell your friends to leave. We just don't have room for this many people. They're not my friends, I protested. I don't know who these people are. Is this some kind of mass protest thing, like when that guy was organizing huge crowds to take off their clothes in public? A slow smile spread over the businessman's pudgy face. You want us to take off our clothes? All right, said the construction worker. Oh, man, said the cyclist, who had snuck behind me to retrieve my slacks from the changing room. I can smell her on these. He took a deep whiff of my pants, and I shouted, hey, and grabbed one of the legs. Stop that, you're being weird, all of you. I need to be upside you, said a Japanese tourist, consulting his phrase book. Inside, he corrected himself, yes? I need to lick you from your toes to your ears, said the cyclist. You touch her and I'll kill you, said the construction worker. That's the future mother of my children you're talking to. Like hell she is, roared the businessman. Liliana ducked under his right arm, which was holding off the hard hat, and took my elbow. I don't suppose you're wearing some exotic new perfume? I'm afraid I am, I admitted. L'air de Estrus. Because it had belatedly occurred to me there was no other explanation for my sudden transformation from plain Jane to femme fatale. Liliana, we have to get out of here. Well, don't change back into your clothes. You're liable to start a riot. Luckily, most of the men were preoccupied with jostling and insulting each other. The businessman and the construction worker were screaming abuse while the Japanese tourists were getting very red in the face as they shouted clipped phrases at the cyclist and the anorak man. The funny thing was, many of the guys were actually quite attractive. The young cyclist had the clean, strong jaw of a scholar athlete. Two of the Japanese tourists were flat-out handsome, and even the anorak man possessed a kind of thuggish appeal. As the tension escalated and the pushing turned to shoving, I found myself watching with reluctant fascination. There was something primitive, almost primal about this scene. Suddenly, the layers of civilization were being peeled back, and what remained was the essential true nature of each individual. The businessman was now a large male, no longer in his prime, whose outward belligerence masked a reluctance to engage in direct battle. The construction worker, by contrast, was a splendidly muscled specimen, warily circling the young Japanese male, who was bouncing lightly on the balls of his feet and crooning to himself in a softly menacing tone. It seemed to me, trapped as I was among these bellicose males, there was no choice except to await the outcome. One male would emerge victorious, his skin damp with exertion, redolent of the powerful male hormones flooding through his body. He would be wounded, no doubt, and yet still possessed by all the savage instincts that had allowed him to conquer the other males. He would come to me then, his body thrumming with adrenaline and lust, his mind half maddened by the intoxicating scent of me. But there would be no use of force. I would still have the power to turn them away, to leave them unsatisfied and burning with desire. Where's my wine? Now the construction worker and the Japanese tourist had removed their shirts, and their bare chests were already gleaming with sweat, as the young saleswoman darted ineffectually about, telling them that she had called the police. I wondered vaguely which one it would be, and how long I would make him wait before permitting him to pleasure me. Abra, Abra, snap out of it. Liliana shook me, and I stared at her uncomprehendingly for a moment. We need to get out of here before the police arrive, especially since you may wind up affecting the cops the way you do the civilians. I turned back to the men. But we can't leave, I said, my heart racing with excitement as the cyclist launched himself at the Japanese tourist, who had just taken down the construction worker with a roundhouse kick. Liliana took a deep breath and said, if you don't get out of here now, Abs, you're going to end up becoming the guest of honor at a gangbang. I said absentmindedly, as the cyclist kicked his opponent in the balls. How much of Liliana's distress, I had to ask, was due to her being the wallflower for once. Not so nice to be the female none of the males even notice. Anyway, that gives you a little taste of the scene, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Can I freshen your wine?
What?
Can I freshen your wine?
Oh, sure, thank you. Can you appreciate it?
That was the Benny Goodman Orchestra. And you know what? I don't know who the vocalist was. Well, I'm sure that somebody out there who knows their stuff can name that vocalist. It was certainly a recognizable voice, but my information right here, just, you know, in from the file, the MP3 that I had, it just says Benny Goodman, and that's how they would always do it. It was the Benny Goodman Orchestra, and they wouldn't necessarily name the vocalist. Sometimes they do it the other way around. You listen to Tommy Dorsey, you go, oh, yeah, that guy singing is familiar. Yeah, his name is Frank Sinatra. Or Paul Whiteman. Could be anybody. Could be Bing Crosby. Could be any number of great vocalists with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. And he varied a great deal. And so did Benny Goodman. Goodman was also really one of the first big bands to break the segregation rules. And that particular recording was certainly an example of that. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and this is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor brought to you in one form or another over these airwaves since 1972. I'm going to be taking next week off. Lister of Burn Baby Burn Clappers will be here starting at 1:30 a.m. And the reason is ReaderCon, my favorite convention of the year. Yeah, I know everybody's warming up for Comic-Con and this and that, and that's not my speed. You know, movies, TV, that's fine. That's great. I love ReaderCon. ReaderCon, the name says it on. It's about books. There are two reading tracks at one time and a lot of wonderful panels. I'll be doing four panels. I'm going to post later on today which panels I'm going to be doing. One of them will be an anniversary discussion of Dahlgren. Another one will be remembering Joanna Russ. She is the guest of honor emeritus, which is to say the dead guest. Every year they have a dead guest of honor. 2 years ago was Roger Zelazny. Last year was Mary Shelley. This year, Joanna Russ. And Gary K. Wolfe is a living guest of honor. He is a brilliant critic and essayist about speculative fiction. And oh dear, I am blanking on who the other GOH guest of honor is. But it's a wonderful convention. It's right outside Boston in the Burlington area. And actually, if you want to find out more, if you think you might want to go, it starts a week from tomorrow, or a week from today, technically, on the East Coast, Thursday. Runs Thursday through Sunday. And go to ReaderCon.org for more details to find out who the other guests are and stuff like that. It's tremendous fun. And I always get a lot of good recordings there and meet up with people, talk with people. Last year at ReaderCon, I put together almost the entire season for New York Review of Science Fiction Readings over like 2 days at ReaderCon. It's that much of a resource, and I hope to do something like that again this year. So Lister will be here in my stead, and got lots of stuff to come up after that, and maybe we can get away without pitching for a little while. Although there is intermittent pitches, by the way, even now, because I am not talking to you out of a studio. I am talking to you out of a room. That's all it is. It's a room. Somebody walks up and down the corridor. You can hear it. Motorcycle goes by on Atlantic Avenue. You can probably hear the license number of that bike. But I've got to say, I love this neighborhood. I like the feel of the space we are in. The up in Harlem, in the middle of the night, in the campus, in this very labyrinthine part of this huge institutional building, it felt antiseptic, and we were guests in somebody else's domain, another radio station, WHCR, which did not necessarily welcome all these outside guests coming in saying, hey, this is our station. You know, I don't blame them. I remember at 120 Wall Street when we were apparently leasing a large studio to outsiders to come in to rehearse theater or to record things or whatever. And I take a look and say, who the bleep are these people? This is our space. Not even knowing that this was a way that the management was raising money for us. And to me, they felt like interlopers, like outsiders. And we must have felt that way to the people up in CCNY. So, but here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, once again, I have a feeling that this is a friendly space. If, oh my God, what a, you know, to say that it needs work is ridiculous. We have, well, yeah, as I said, no soundproofing. We don't even, I'm not even in a room with a wall that reaches the ceiling due to fire code. It goes, I'd say, there's about 2 feet from the top, of the wall of the room that I'm in to the ceiling. After that, it's just, you know, out to the corridor. I've got the door open. What's the difference? We had boxes lining there, and the fire department came in and said, you can't do that, so we aren't doing that. So be it. We need to finish this studio. So when another program, there are a few intermittent shows this week and next, not me, not Lister, that are going to be asking you for money, do it. Just do it. We need a bleeping studio here. We need to enclose this room. We need soundproofing. I need a console that I can work with. I've already put up some Instagram pictures of what it is we're working here. During the next thing that I play, I will probably do some more because it is laughable. The listeners sitting here laughing. Yes, it's laughable. It really is. The room itself is laughing. You know, what can I say? But I like the place. It's got a feel to it. It's got a positive personality. And that's not always the case at WBAI. So, there. Okay. Speaking, by the way, the ground floor here is just utterly magnificent. That is where I hold the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. And the and I'm moving there semi-permanently starting September. And what's more, it's moving from just something that I record and occasionally broadcast to live television. If you go to livestream.com, or if you have the app on your phone or your Roku device or whatever, you can go to live stream and you can type in the name of my reading series, which is NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction. And we did three experimental readings there about 2 months ago, and they were great. They were incredibly fun. There, we have three robotic cameras. There's a huge noise buzz that is in the background, but the technical director for my reading series, Terrence Taylor, was working with fellow Nick, who helped build the downstairs for the owner of the building, Melissa, and we've gotten rid of that. Now, the fact that I'm holding that reading series in this same building is totally independent of WBAI. But if we can get this place rolling, if we can do something with this place, dare I mention for you old-timers out there, something like the Free Music Store? Anybody out there know what that was? If you do, think about it. We have a place in which we can revive these things, in which we can do theater, public forums, events. But first, we gotta build this bleeping studio. Okay. So speaking of that reading series, New York Review of Science Fiction readings, here's one that goes nicely way back. A fellow who has done so well for himself in the last few years that he actually got to the point where at one time he almost denied that he ever writes science fiction. You get to a point where, you like Kurt Vonnegut did, you are doing such quality work. If you are labeled as science fiction, you're going to get paid 5 cents a word. If you're labeled as a great writer or something like that, you're getting $8 a word. 5 cents a word versus $8 a word. Okay, you can't blame him. Anyhow, Jonathan Lethem is a great science fiction writer who, at this point, people call, he writes literature that uses the imagination. Okay, go bandy it about. His first novel was called Gun with Occasional Music. It took place on Pluto with a private investigator who's a gun-toting kangaroo. Now, if that's not speculative fiction, if that's just plain, ordinary literature, more power to you. I call it science fiction. There, I hope it didn't burn out the microphone. Okay. His second novel, which we're about to hear some selections from, was called Amnesia Moon. His best-known novel, by the way, is Motherless Brooklyn. And one of these years, that will be made into a major movie. At one point, Spielberg was going to make it. And Jonathan has since left Brooklyn. He's now in California in a major seat at a university and all that. You know, he is big. He is one of the giants of modern literature today. But there was a time when he would come and read at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. This particular one comes from, I'm pretty sure I have, yes, from the year 2000. It was October 19th. And he was already well established. This is his second novel, and a lot of short stories. And Amnesia Moon was very, very much in the mode of Philip K. Dick. In fact, Jonathan has been like the leader of the PKD Society, the Philip K. Dick Society, and is a master of all things Dickesque or Dickian or whatever one would call Philip K. Dick. Okay, so it runs half an hour, which means if I start it now, it will end on time. So set your way back machine again, this time a little bit further to the year aught, or that is to say to the year 2000 in October, and listen to, I believe it will be Claire Wolfe, who at the time was the curator of the reading series, introduce Jonathan Lethem.
Now, Jonathan Lethem, the author of Gun with Occasional Music, a fabulous first novel, winner of the William L. Crawford Award for New Fantasy Fiction, a Nebula finalist, the recipient of one of the most fabulous packages in science fiction publishing history, in my personal humble opinion, and a damn good novel, which is now followed by Amnesia Moon, which is just out, also a damn good novel, also a fabulous package, and the one we're about to hear pieces of. Hooray!
I'm going to read two bits from Amnesia Moon. And the first one is a sort of less than usual Wednesday in the life of a woman living in Vacaville. It was Wednesday, moving day again. Every Wednesday and Saturday were moving days, but Saturdays were simpler because the boys were with their father. That was how she thought of him now. Not Gerald, not my ex, but their father. Just drop the boys off on Friday, move alone on Saturday afternoon, and pick them up and show them the new place on Sunday night. Whereas Wednesdays, she had to convince Ray and Dave to abandon whatever playthings or hideouts they'd latched onto in the current house, and to say goodbye to the kids they'd befriended on the street, and then shepherd them into the car before the new family showed up to take over the house. Today, as she moved the last of her bags of clothing out to the car, Ray and Dave were nowhere to be seen. She was late again. The neighboring houses had emptied, and she was afraid the boys were sneaking in basement windows to explore and ransack. Not a pleasant thought. If the boys were caught in an empty house when the new occupants arrived, they'd probably be issued a citation, and she was only two citations short of having to appear before the luck board and make another appeal. Ray and Dave were underage, so their citations counted against her. A few more times before the board, and she'd be sent to a bad luck camp. Except she probably wouldn't. Cooley would see to that. She knew Cooley would keep her right where he had her, right on the verge of losing it all, helpless, dependent on his favors. It was his miserable, fucked-up way of flirting with her. She scanned the street for a sign of the boys as she loaded her belongings into the trunk. She kept too much stuff when she moved, more clothing than you were supposed to have, and a small knapsack full of books, which you weren't supposed to move from house to house at all. You were supposed to be satisfied to read whatever books or magazines you found in your new place, and not want to take any of them with you. Someone could give her a ticket for that, too. But she was cautious, camouflaging the books with oily rags and a kit of wrenches and screwdrivers and pushing them into the corner of the trunk so they looked like something that went with the car. She got in and honked, then started the car and drove slowly around the block to find the boys. It was 12:15, and the new families were beginning to arrive. She recognized a couple of faces, people she'd lived below or above or beside in some previous apartment building or neighborhood. She knew hundreds of people slightly, by sight. The system discouraged anything more than that. Neighbors, even friendly ones, rarely bothered exchanging names. Though the day was bright, it wasn't too hot. The new address was all the way across town, but as long as it wasn't too hot, she wouldn't mind the drive. They'd put her somewhere on the outskirts this time, an area beyond the old refineries, a place she'd never lived before despite moving twice a week. She'd heard the houses were big and isolated, which she wouldn't mind. But there was no sign of the boys until she turned the last corner back to the house she'd just vacated and found them standing on the curb with Cooley. He had his hands on their shoulders and a big grin on his face, the bastard. Had he caught them stealing? Cooley was a luck investigator, and though she didn't completely understand the organization of the Vacaville Luck Institute, she knew he was somewhere near the top of it. Not that his work kept him from coming to pester her whenever he felt like it. She'd done her initial luck test with him, and he'd taken a far too personal interest in her case ever since. She'd scored low, very low. Low enough that she might have had to give up her car, let Gerald take the kids, and move right into one of the bad luck shelters if Cooley hadn't intervened. And Cooley would never let her forget it. He especially liked to drop in on moving day, when she was most flustered. Ray, Dave, come get in the car. Hello, Edie, said Cooley, stepping up with the two boys. Lose track of the Calamity twins here? She granted him the point. Obviously, she'd been looking for them. Were they stealing? She asked tensely. Cooley was a wide man. That was the only word for it. He wasn't fat, more like a skinny cartoon character who'd swallowed a door and retained its shape. He always wore suits, even in the hottest weather, and they hung on him like bedsheets drying on a line. His face was the same way, too wide, eyes too far apart, a reptilian smile that stretched on and on. No, Mom, said Ray. Mr. Cooley was just showing us the sewers. There's frogs living down there. I found the boys at the end of the street, said Cooley. We saw you go around the block, but you didn't see us. So I walked back up here. Dave thought you moved without us, said Ray sardonically. I did not, said Dave. Well, get in the car. Come on. She held the door open. Thanks, Ian, she said to Cooley, hoping he'd leave. The boys climbed into the seat beside her, and she reached over and locked the passenger door. Cooley walked in front of the car and around to her side. New places all the way across town, he said. You've been looking at my file again. Hey, I punch up your file and just let it sit there on the screen, he said, grinning. It's like having a picture of you on my desk. That's nice. She was weary of his insinuations. Well, you don't know what's nice about it yet. Your new place is just around the corner from where I'll be living. Cooley, like other high-level government officials, moved among a better class of houses, the kind she'd seen only on television. Of course, as he often pointed out, she could live in them herself if she moved in with him. You're in that little farmhouse behind the wrecking yard, he said. Nearest thing to my place. You'll have to come see how I live up there. This takes away your excuse. She nodded back at the kids. Maybe when they're at their father's. Ian has a treehouse in his yard, interrupted Ray. We could play in it if you let us, Mom. You'll disappoint the boys. I've got to get moved in, Ian, she said, thinking, you shit. Don't play the boys off me like this. She released the handbrake and let the car inch forward. Stop by later when I can think, okay? Tonight? Try me. No guarantees. He smiled. Good enough. He gave a thumbs-up signal to the boys, and they returned it, unwitting conspirators against her. She drove away, leaving Cooley standing in the street. The new place was indeed behind the wrecking yard and behind the old velament factory and the in high school. It was the only house for miles around, a leftover from a residential neighborhood that had been demolished for industry. A little scary, thinking of her and Cooley all the way out here alone. But it was only a few days. That was the good side of moving. It was always only a few days. She parked in the street outside the yard and gave Ray and Dave each a small bag to drag in. At the front door, she sensed something wrong. Not the television playing. That was common. People left things running all the time, sometimes even the water in the sink. But there were sounds in the kitchen. She went in to investigate, still holding her suitcase, the boys trailing behind her. A very dirty man sat at the kitchen table, eating chicken and drinking orange juice with a girl. Edie would have called the girl dirty, too, if there hadn't been something more notable about her. She was furry, like a seal or otter. The man and girl looked up, still chewing, but didn't say anything. Edie felt a surge of anger and confusion, but swept it away. She knew how to deal with this. It was a blessing in disguise. She only had to find her summons book, and she could give out a citation. Maybe she'd meet her quota this month after all. She patted her pockets. It wasn't with her. Ray, she said, ignoring the man and girl. Go to the car and find my ticket book. You remember what it looks like. He dropped his bag and disappeared. She turned back to the pair at the table. I'm giving you a ticket. Then you have to move. It's past 12. I mean, I'm even running late, so I'm sorry, but you've earned it. Where's your car? The man swallowed his bite of chicken and said, we left it by the highway. A ticket to what? Mommy, said Dave, why's her hair like that? Dave, that's not polite. Go in the other room or help your brother unpack the car. Dave went. I'm sorry, he's only 6. You left your car where? By the highway? The man nodded. It didn't work anymore, he said. Edie felt confused. Where were these two going? How could they move without a car? I'm not from around here, said the man. I'm sorry. We needed to eat. Slowly the air went out of her. This wasn't right. She wasn't going to get to write a ticket after all. It was turning into more bad luck, more proof that her low score on the test really meant something. The way things were going lately, the appearance in her house of the man and the furry girl would probably turn out to be a thing someone could write her a citation for. Where are you from? She asked. Wyoming, started the man. Hat Fork, said the girl reprovingly. But we've been on the road for a while, the man went on. There haven't been many good places to stop. Well, that's my food you're eating, said Edie, and this is my house you've stopped in. Your food, said the hairy girl. I thought you just got here. As of 12, it's mine, said Edie. It was exhausting to think she had to explain moving to them. Before that, it was somebody else's, not yours. The boys appeared in the doorway behind her, Ray with her summons book. Here, Mom. It's okay, she said. Put it in the living room. We'll go, said the man. I'm sorry. It's okay, Edie said. Why don't you stop, catch your breath, use the shower if you like. She couldn't help wanting to introduce this person to some hot water and soap. The boys were standing in the doorway, staring at the girl with the fur. The girl made her eyes wide and stuck out her tongue, and the boys tittered. Well, thanks, said the man. Then you have to find another place to go, said Edie quickly. If you want to stay in Vacaville, you have to register, you know. Sign up for work shifts. Take a luck test. Okay, he said. I'll find out about all that. He made it sound very unimportant. I guess I will go take that shower. He got up from the table, leaving the remains of his meal there, and went past her and the boys through the kitchen doorway, his eyes lowered shyly. Ray said to the girl, "Want to watch TV?" She didn't answer, but squirted past Edie into the living room to follow the boys. Edie unpacked the rest of the luggage into a pile on the living room rug while Ray and Dave and the girl sat watching television. Test Your Luck was on, the afternoon game show. Edie could make out the sound of the shower running upstairs. After she emptied the car, she went in and cleaned up the kitchen, by habit cataloging her new larder in the process. Then she made the boys' sandwiches and went and sat and watched them watch television. Ray and Dave had a game of rooting for opposing contestants, which turned any viewing of the show into a shouting match. The girl, meanwhile, sat transfixed and silent. When the man came downstairs, he looked quite different. He'd found a razor, apparently, and scraped the shadow off his face. Though he wore the same drab shirt and jeans, his ratty hair wasn't ratty anymore. It was slicked back wet over his head, exposing his forehead and eyes, which were strong, stronger than his mouth and chin. Thanks, said the man again. Then he turned to the girl. Melinda, go upstairs and get cleaned up. We should leave before long. Okay. She rubbed at her furry nose with the back of her hand, then tore herself from the television. Where? The man pointed to the stairs and the girl shuffled petulantly away. But no sound of running water came from upstairs this time. Edie went up to take a look. She found the girl standing in the bathroom, staring at the tub. What's the matter? Edie said. The girl made a sour face. You want to show me how? Edie turned on the shower for her, and the girl said, "Can't you just fill it up? I've done that before." So Edie filled the tub. "My name is Edie," she ventured. "You're Melinda?" "Yeah." "Are you his daughter?" "Who, Chaos?" "No." Edie considered repeating the strange name the girl had used, but she was unsure. "He's taking care of you, though." "I don't need taking care of," said the girl defiantly. "We're just, you know, going around together." Edie didn't know what that meant, but she left it alone. The girl seemed too young, but what did she know about the man downstairs, or the place they'd come from? She knew things were weird in other places right now, and these two were definitely weird. She thought, "I left him downstairs with the boys." But she wasn't afraid. The girl stripped off her filthy jeans and ragged, stained T-shirt. The clothes stank. Edie pushed them into the tiled corner of the bathroom and thought about offering the girl something of her own to wear. As Melinda slipped into the tub, her fur billowed out, swaying in the water, which almost instantly turned gray. "Soap?" asked Edie. "You got shampoo?" Edie gave her shampoo and then left her alone, shutting the bathroom door. Downstairs, the television was off, and Ray and Dave were teaching the man a complicated board game. More of Ray's hopeless explanations, made worse this time by Dave's attempts to help. The man looked bewildered and tired, though she knew Ray and Dave wouldn't notice that. She saw in a minute that the boys were latching on to this visitor the way they had with Ian Cooley, the way they did with almost any grown man except Gerald, their father. Then the girl yelled from upstairs, "Hey!" The man and Edie looked at each other. "What?" the man called back. "Not you, Edie." Edie went upstairs and into the bathroom. The girl was sitting in the muddy water, bent over and probing between her legs. The gray water showed a little cloud of pink there. Blood. The girl lifted a reddened finger from the bath. Edie thought instantly, "He's a rapist." The girl looked up and gave Edie a weak smile and said, "I heard about this." "You have your period," said Edie, astonished. "I never did before." Edie tried to gather herself. She'd lived this moment once from the other side. Having only boys, she wasn't expecting to live it again. The girl swirled the water between her legs, dispersing the stain, and looked up at Edie again. "I'll get you something," said Edie, blushing, feeling idiotic. She would have to show her how to use it, she realized. A girl who didn't know how to run a shower wouldn't know how to use a pad. "Are you ready to get out?" The girl nodded. She stood up in the water and gently shook her fur, starting with her arms and working downward. The spray was remarkably controlled. Edie pulled a towel off the shelf and wrapped the girl in it and began fluffing her dry. The girl let herself be held. Then Edie sat her on the toilet, still wrapped in the towel, and carefully showed her where the pad went. The girl followed Edie's instructions, reverent, unembarrassed. Afterwards, Edie got a clean set of clothes from downstairs. She left the girl there to dress and went back down. Coming in the front door, just as she reached the living room, was Cooley. "Wanted to welcome you to the neighborhood," he said. He grinned and raised his hands as if to ward off a blow. "Thought I'd suggest dinner. See, you've got a guest, though." "Yes," she said. "Don't recognize you from around here," Cooley said to the man. "He's my cousin," said Edie quickly. "He's just passing through." "Mom," said Ray disapprovingly. "Don't mom me. You and Dave clean up that game and take your bags upstairs." "There's only my car parked outside," she realized. Cooley would notice that on his way out. "Cousin, eh? My name's Ian Cooley." Cooley stuck out his hand. The man turned away from the board game and shook hands with Cooley. "I'm Chaos," he said. So she'd heard it right upstairs. "Chaos. Interesting name. Staying a while?" No. Like she said, just passing through. Too bad. I'm going north myself this weekend. Shoot some ducks. Cooley hefted an imaginary shotgun and fired at the ceiling. You like to shoot? The man named Chaos looked bewildered again. I don't know, he said. Ian, said Edie, he's tired. Come back another. Okay, okay, so we're on for tonight? We never were on for tonight, said Edie. I'm tired too, Ian. Another time, please. Know when I'm not wanted. See you, boys. Ray and Dave stopped and waved from the stairs. And see you, cousin. Cooley leaned on cousin too hard. You decide to stick around. I'll get you all signed up and stuff. And have Edie here tell you about bad luck. She knows all about that. Bad luck? Said Chaos. Yeah. Edie's sort of an expert in that department. Tell the truth, when I first came in, I thought you might be another manifestation. You know, take in some drifter, lie to cover for him. Another one of her wild swerves off the straight and narrow. Good to know you're actually family. Melinda came down the stairs, and Cooley's voice trailed away to a whistle. Hello, you didn't say you had a traveling partner. Melinda stopped on the bottom step and glared. That's quite a fur coat you've got there, young lady. Go, Ian. Edie moved towards him, actually balling her fists, thinking she would have to drive him out. Right, he said, backpedaling. Later. Stay in touch, Edie. And out of trouble. He turned and walked out, across the porch, and back to his car. Edie discovered she'd been holding her breath. I'm sorry, Chaos said. We'll go. No, said Edie. Now you'd better stay, at least for tonight. The second bit of this book that I'm going to read is from a part of the book where there's a couple of characters have fallen into the clutches of a guy named Ilford who has the ability to enslave people by turning them into features of his living room. The clock was happy. It felt itself to be the very embodiment of pride and purpose clacking. The work was second nature. To be a clock was to tick, but to be this clock was to clack. The sound itself was golden. And reflecting, that was the great work, the distinction. The curved casing of the clock held the whole room in miniature, bent and gilded. But the light flowed both ways. As the shimmering pendulum swung again and again, an inch from the glass table, magical specks of light raced along the walls of the room, touching everything, dancing in flamboyant courses that were repeated exactly. The beams confirmed the arrangement of the room, each item glowing in its right place, even as the reflection in the casing of the clock drew everything together into a detailed, burnished knot. Conferred, conferring, what a privilege. Clack. The room was happy all over. The clock was aware of the fantastic pleasure the oak chair took in just being the oak chair, claiming nothing more. It was possible even to envy the oak chair, grain glowing beneath so many fine, thin layers of varnish, wooden spokes of the seat back, marvelously warped. Ilford might sit there. But then the clock knew that when Ilford entered the room through any doorway and stood or sat anywhere, he would be held and honored in the clock's gleaming case and would experience the clock's counting as a steadying pulse, and that was better. The chair was fine, but the clock was finer. The clock felt the satisfied presences of all the furnishings in the room, the paintings, the glass table, the lamp with the marble base, even the row of beveled glasses and the stoppered crystal bottle of scotch behind the doors in the inlaid rosewood cabinet, even the bonsai trees in a row on the mantel, except for that one at the end, which seemed a little edgy, a little discontented. Clack. Today it was raining through the fog, so the windows were jeweled with reflective drops themselves. They twinkled. The fog kept the windows opaque, not so much portals to the outside as mirrors of the room, even when it wasn't raining. The clock faced no competition from the sun. All light and warmth emanated from the room, and the clock was the shining center of that system. Nothing else was as sure. The clock had never been fogged over. The sun almost always was. The room was perfect, but incomplete. It was waiting, inevitably, for Ilford to return. What was the point of the perfection, the soft glowing, if not for Ilford to move through and inhabit? Clack. The clock and the rest of the room didn't have to wait long today. Ilford came in, shaking rain from his coat onto the carpet. Now, taken strictly, his presence created imperfection. The droplets soaking into the weave, the cabinet door now ajar as he poured himself a drink, the clinking and clunking of his movements so disorderly beside the metronomic voice of the clock. As groomed and clean as Ilford was, he was no match for his own perfect house. But that didn't matter. With him inside, the house could really live and breathe, fulfilled. The clock, for one, admired Ilford enormously. It couldn't completely say why. In fact, it couldn't begin to. But reflecting Ilford so that he was unified in golden miniature with his perfect possessions, upholding the standard of Ilford's perfect reasonableness and good judgment with unerring timekeeping, these duties, these privileges really, were the point of the clock's whole clack. Instead of moving unself-consciously past the clock, moving with his usual ease, his body speaking with every gesture that he possessed his perfect house with that indifferent, casual power that thrilled the clock and thrilled all the furnishings, Ilford had stared. As he set his glass of scotch on the table, he had turned his head a little awkwardly and stared with wide-eyed uncertainty right at the clock's face, and his hand had trembled just a little. This passed, but was replaced by something else inappropriate, something obscene. Ilford's insecure look switched to one that was possessive and gloating. He looked at the clock as though it were something threatening that had been subdued, a lion's head stuffed and mounted on a hunter's wall, instead of the devoted and faithful servant that it was. Neither look should have been necessary. Clack. The clock became troubled. Ilford raised his glass and drank, and everything was normal again. The clock knew that none of the other furnishings had noticed, and that they were all sure of their place around Ilford, and Ilford's place among them, presiding. Only the clock was disturbed. As the clock began to remember, it became very frightened. It went on keeping perfect time, even as it began to remember that just as Ilford was not only Ilford, so the clock was not only a clock. In fact, the part of the clock that mattered wasn't a clock at all. Clack. Ilford lifted his drink and rose from the couch, his posture perfect, command completely restored. Outside the rain fell, but Ilford didn't pause to glance at the windows. He moved towards the stairs to the second floor. The room was mildly disappointed to see him go, but it honored the decision, even offered silent murmurs of encouragement and congratulations. The room didn't object, but the clock did. The clock suddenly didn't want Ilford out of its sight. So it stopped time. Ilford was frozen where he stood, one foot lifted to the bottom step, the scotch in his glass tilted against gravity in the same direction as the stopped pendulum of the clock. "I'm leaving," the clock told the bonsai at the left-hand end of the mantel. "Ilford won't let you," said the potted tree. "Look at what he's done already to keep you here." Thanks.
Jonathan Lethem at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings in October of the year 2000. That reading produced by Claire Wolfe and recorded by myself, Jim Freund. And this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And coming up in just 5 minutes will be Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lester, who will be filling in for me next week as I go off to ReaderCon. I should mention, by the way, that I have finished watching Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, and I read an assessment of the finale on Tor.com, and I agreed pretty much with what the person there wrote, which is to say the finale should have been 2 hours long. It's a lot of information, very compressed. There are, of course, differences from the book. It is an adaptation, not a precise telling, but it is a good adaptation, and I heartily recommend you check out, read the book. How's that for an idea? Read the book, and after that, enjoy the television series. It's been very, very good. Peter Harness wrote it. He's also done some Doctor Who, and will be doing some more in time to come. So, thank you all for listening. You can check out the Facebook page for Hour of the Wolf. Join the group. And also for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, if you like to get the schedule, especially as we start up our 25th anniversary season in September. And again, be good to each other, enjoy yourselves, enjoy the summer, and have a good time. If you're going to ReaderCon, find me, say hello. Good morning, take care.
Uninsured? Need prescription drugs? Are you a pet owner in need of prescription drugs? Do you want to reduce your healthcare costs? WBAI is proud to offer you a free national drug card that will save you 10 to 85% on FDA-approved drugs in virtually all New York metropolitan pharmacies. Are you a senior citizen on fixed income and Medicare? In college? Self-employed and paying medical costs? Recently unemployed or have no insurance? Then the NDC is right for you. No deductibles or fees, no forms to complete, and everyone qualifies. WBAI receives $1.75 for each prescription or benefit you choose to use. You can even get the WBAI Group RX app on your phone. For more information, visit WBAI.org. Don't waste another minute and get your free drug card today.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
You're listening to WBAI, 99.5 FM, Pacifica Radio, and online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI. Speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
Hey there, friends. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Help us with our recovery. Go to WBAI.org and help us by joining the Buddy System. The more people we have on a recurrent basis giving money to the station, the less we'll have to have fund drives. Help us cut down on those, and we'll do what we can for you. WBAI.org. Buddy. Make a difference.
Children, this is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping. You listen to WBAI FM 99.5, New York City. It's listener sponsored, children. It's commercial free. Ooh, Changealooyah.
Hi, I'm Katie Halper. I'm a comedian, filmmaker, and writer. And now I'm the host of a brand new show, creatively titled The Katie Halper Show. You can check out The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. here on WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM or at WBAI.org. The Katie Halper Show takes a comedic look at the news, politics, pop culture, and the arts so you can laugh instead of cry. See you on Wednesdays here at The Katie Halper Show.
When I leave, you can know my said, but the last words on my lips, I am. And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
bitch.
The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
We'll be right back.
law for me, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the big dribble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Michael Franti from
Spirit. When I leave, you remember I said
non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to.
Peace. Oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God.
This is Chloe Glickman, and I'm an intern at WBAI. Looking to get professional experience doing something you're actually passionate about? At WBAI, I'm able to develop skills in journalism, marketing, event planning, editing, social networking, and much more, all all while working directly with producers and the management team. BAI is always taking applications for credit and non-credit internships, so get in touch today. Send an email to internships@wbai.org for more information. Join the team that supplied New York with independent radio for over 50 years. Help keep community radio going strong.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial.